Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marches, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me.
I want to tell you about the first time I was 21 years old and I saw $6 million of cash right in front of me. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. That's what $6 million looks like. Insane. How the hell can I get this kind of money one day? And the guy who had the $6 million was a Jewish businessman who owned dealerships in San Fernando Valley area. And he gave me an advice at 21 that completely changed the way I do business till today. By the way, if you get value from today's message, give it a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. Here's what this Jewish businessman told me. I said, how is it possible you got this much money and you're in your mid-30s, $6 million cash? He says, Patrick, there's one thing you need to know about Jews. I said, what's that? When one makes money, five make money. I said, what? He says, when one of us makes money in a business, five other Jews make money because we like to make money in groups. I said, so what's the benefit of that? He said, everybody keeps doing business together. He says, too many people, ethnicities, nationalities, cultures, backgrounds, they just want to be the one making money. They don't want anybody else around them making money. And then eventually they wonder, how come nobody wants to go into business with me? Because when you make money, nobody else makes money. So ask yourself the question. Number one, the person you're working for, does he make money and do you make money? And number two, the people that work with you, who report to you, if they give their best, do they also make good money the way you're making money? If the answer is yes, you're in a great place. Go do your part, and eventually you'll make your money like that Jewish mentor shared with this 21-year-old 24 years ago, 23 years ago. If you got value from this video, give it a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. And if you've never watched the video, 20 Rules of Money, How Actually Money Works, click here to watch the video, 20 Rules of Money. Take care, everybody.
at the new archway. All organic. This is all under construction.
I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I didn't have nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing, but he spoke to me. And however, he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit. So I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone. And I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called and I punched in the code and the dude said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this is it. I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, wanting to be on TV, I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday and I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It says, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This was a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the 150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I call Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on a plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man, so... He said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in a dressing room on the 6th floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, and I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw on the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the sixth floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there. Another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduced myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I'd have had this four pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie, then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass, then he went back to them jokes, and they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps, and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened.
The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just say, Lord, Lord, Lord.
And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. They paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I had never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job on Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting, and I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn-back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn-back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up, no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida, I make $300. Then I go to New York, I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful.
I say people are starting to ask me why. Why I never laugh. I don't laugh no more and I don't smile. At all. At all. At all.
By now, you're all excited to run out there and convert a car to electric. But what car do you convert? A lot of times people ask me, can I convert any car? Or will a X work well as a conversion? Well, the truth is you can convert any car you want to electric, but some are going to be better than others. In general, if the car got good fuel economy as a gasoline car, in general, it's going to make a better electric conversion. But there's a couple things we have to think about. One is just size. First of all, you might be a bigger person, you might be a smaller person, so you might need a larger or smaller cabin space on the car, just depending on who you are. You might also want either a two-seater or a four-seater, depending on how you use the vehicle. Maybe it's just you driving around by yourself. Maybe you need to carry a child seat or carry your family with you. So that's going to be important, too. Also for size, we're going to need enough room for all of our batteries. Since we're using lead-acid batteries, they're heavy and they're pretty bulky too, so we're going to need room for those to go. We also need to consider the weight of the car. Heavier cars are going to take more energy to push down the road, so they're going to be less efficient. We're not going to be able to drive as far in a heavy car as we would on a lightweight car. You also want to keep in mind the engine style and location. Engines can be in the front or the back of a car. They could be mounted longitudinal. They could be mounted transverse. For example,
usually in normal times, it would be strange to lead a newscast with the firing of a former reality TV contestant. But let's face it, no matter where you are on the political spectrum, you'd probably agree these are not exactly normal times. So we begin tonight with Omarosa Manigault Newman, fired three times from The Apprentice and once from the White House. Fool me once, shame on you. Fooled me four times, I don't even know who's to blame. Manigault Newman, who last we saw was whispering to Ross on Celebrity Big Brother, is now trying to sell a book and is waging a war of words of sort with her old boss, President Trump. She's releasing tapes of conversations made on the job, including one with the president. And she promises more recordings of phone calls, according to Politico, with first daughter Ivanka and son-in-law Jared Kushner. Manigault Newman once held a senior position in the White House Office of Public Liaison. She drew the highest salary possible for the White House.
This is the city, Los Angeles, California. 464.8 square miles of real estate. It takes a lot of departments and agencies to keep it going. Fire, water and power, education, health. There's a Department of Airports, a Harbor Department, and libraries. There's also a Department for Law and Order. This is Parker Center. I work here. I carry a badge. It was Monday, June 29th. It was warm in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of homicide. The boss is Captain Brown. My partner's Bill Gannon. My name's Friday. Mrs. Lily Burnham, a real estate broker, has been reported missing. The preliminary investigation indicated a strong possibility of foul play.
The story you are about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
I drove over to the offices of the Burnham Realty Company, 9.05 a.m.
Good morning. May I help you?
Police officers, this is Bill Gannon. My name's Friday.
I'll tell Mr. Richmond you're here.
Thank you.
I'll just be a moment.
Oh, take a look at this, Joe. Beautiful home, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can tell quality construction. 3+10, 2 baths, built-ins. What do you figure the asking is?
The what?
The asking price. How much for this one?
Well, I wouldn't have any idea.
Got to be 42.5. Probably take 39.7 today's market.
Is that right?
You bet. I know the market pretty good.
You do, huh?
Every Sunday we go for a drive. Eileen will watch for open houses, you know, furnished models.
Yeah.
We stop and go through them, spend the whole afternoon. We've seen some great buys, Joe.
Well, I didn't know you were interested in the new house.
What makes you say that?
Well, I mean, you're out looking at all those great buys.
Well, you've been out to my place.
That's right.
What's wrong with the house I've got?
Sergeant Friday, this is Mr. Richmond, one of our salesmen.
Sergeant.
My partner, Officer Bill Gannon.
Well, you gentlemen aren't here to buy a house, so I better let you do the talking.
Wonder if we could have your name, miss.
That's right, Miss Walters. Ida Walters.
And you filed a missing report, did you?
Well, yes, sir. I'm Mrs. Burnham's secretary.
Ida phoned an in, Sergeant, on my say-so.
How long has she been missing?
From our happy little circle since Friday afternoon. Went out to show some property about 2 o'clock.
2:15, I saw her drive away.
Did you? Well, then, Ida must have been the last one to see her.
She didn't even phone in again.
Was that unusual?
Yes, sir.
The weekend, gentlemen. That's when we move houses. A man and wife, generally, they can't get out together during the week, so we spend Saturdays and Sundays sitting in a furnished model, wheeling and dealing. You know.
Yes, sir.
Now, you take Miss Lily. She's a businesswoman. Nothing would keep her from a weekend of wheeling and dealing.
Something did.
Yeah, that's why we reported it.
Maybe she's sick.
I called her apartment house. Somebody looked in.
Yes, ma'am.
They don't think she's been there all weekend.
She might have gone out of town. Has that ever happened before?
Not on a weekend.
Does she have relatives?
There's a sister, I think, in Philadelphia. Nobody out here.
Well, there must have been a husband at one time. What about him?
He's never mentioned.
All right. Does she have a boyfriend?
There's Terry Williams, but it looks like he doesn't know anything either.
Mr. Williams has been calling us 2 or 3 times on Friday and again this morning.
I see. Well, maybe there's somebody else.
Wouldn't matter, Sergeant.
Well, how's that?
She had an appointment this morning to close the deal. No man would ever stand between Lily and the commission, or a woman either.
Maybe that's the secret of her success.
You have to understand, gentlemen, Ida is the president of the Miss Lily Fan Club. I work here just for money. It gives us different perspectives.
Do you need me for anything else?
We'll need a description of Mrs. Burnham.
Well, she's attractive, I guess, if you lack them cold and ruthless. Age, what would you say, Ida?
About 36.
Yeah, 36 going on 42. But she's kept her figure and knows how to dress.
You remember what she was wearing Friday?
Your department, Ida.
It was her paisley linen dress. Over it, she wore a matching linen coat.
What color?
The dress was orange and yellow, and the coat was yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And bone leather shoes with a matching purse. It's very smart.
Yes, ma'am. Anything else?
No, except we're all terribly worried. It's just not like Mrs. Burnham. She must have had an accident or something.
Something has kept her away, but knowing our Lily...
Yeah.
I doubt it was an accident.
Before leaving the realty office, we learned that Terry Williams, the missing woman's boyfriend, was the day bartender at a bar on West Adams. We also obtained the make, model, and license number of Mrs. Burnham's car. 10:50 a.m., we went back to the office, and after checking R&I, we put out a teletype describing the vehicle with a request that, if observed, to notify Homicide Division. 11:05 a.m., we drove over to West Adams to interview Terry Williams, Mrs. Burnham's boyfriend.
Good morning.
Terry Williams.
That's right.
Police officers.
Mm-hmm. It's about Lily Burnham, isn't it?
That's right.
Only thing it could be. The secretary said they were going to report it if she didn't show up soon. Guess she hasn't, huh?
When did you see her last?
Thursday night. With dinner, a couple of drinks. Broke it up early.
See her over the weekend?
No, sir.
You didn't make a date with her?
Nothing definite. Said I'd call. Maybe we'd get together.
Did you call?
A few times. Got no answer.
How long have you known Mrs. Burnham?
Guess it must be close to a year now.
She got any other boyfriends that you know of?
Don't see how she could. We were together most of the time.
But not over the weekend?
That's right. Because she wasn't in when I called. I explained all that.
Would you happen to have a photograph of her?
No, sir.
Use the phone.
Do you know if Mrs. Burnham carried a lot of cash?
She was never short, but not enough to go very far. That's what you're thinking.
That's not what I'm thinking.
Robbery? How much do you need to get mugged these days?
Not very much.
Excuse me. Got a customer down here.
Nothing on Williams. Local boy, clean all the way through high school.
Yeah.
Mrs. Burnham's car turned up. They want it moved before tonight. They need the space.
Who's that?
Car's in a restaurant parking lot.
A.M. According to the parking lot attendant, the car had been discovered on the lot Saturday morning. It was first assumed the owner, deciding he was incapable of driving, had gone home in a cab and would return for it the next day. When it was still there 48 hours later, it was reported abandoned.
Book of real estate listings.
Keys are in the ignition.
Gas receipt, Mrs. Lily Burnham, 17 gallons.
Tank's almost full. Where'd she buy the gas?
Station out near Hanson Dam.
12 noon. Before leaving the lot, we arranged to have Mrs. Burnham's car gone over by SID. An examination of the loose leaf book revealed 8 listings in the Hanson Dam area. 12:20 p.m., we interviewed the attendant at Jackson & Martin Super Service. After hearing a description of Mrs. Burnham in her car, he thought he remembered her from last Friday. He was almost certain there had been a man in the car with her, but he was unable to give us any description of him. We got a copy of the recent listings from the Burnham Realty Company. We also picked up a set of keys for the houses. 12:35 p.m., we started checking the various listings. The occupants of the houses told us Mrs. Burnham had not been there at any time in the past month. 12:48 p.m., the third house we checked was vacant and still for sale.
What was it, number 1223?
That's right.
Yeah, here we are. Lipstick on them. Could have been here a long time.
Yeah, I'll check the rest of the place. Bill.
Orange and yellow linen dress, boom shoes, matching handbag.
Yep.
Mrs. Lily Burnham.
p.m. In answer to our request, a field supervisor and 2 radio units arrived at the scene. One unit was stationed at the end of the street to keep out curious onlookers. The other was sent to cruise the area in the hopes of locating witnesses. Men from SID were also dispatched. The room was dusted for fingerprints. Photographs, both in black and white and color, were taken of the victim.
You want to take a look at this now? Outside was wiped clean. $50 in bills.
Inside's pretty neat, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't look like anybody prowled it. Usual stuff in it. Compact lipstick, nail file, comb.
Yeah. Better take these beads along. They're broken.
I was just thinking.
Yeah?
This purse, the stuff in it. Not like my wife's.
What do you mean?
You know what's missing? Credit cards.
Well, we know she had a gas card.
Not anymore, she doesn't.
p.m. The radio unit, which had been cruising the area, had located a possible witness. Frank Stobie, a local handyman, told us that while riding past the house on his bicycle at roughly 2:30 p.m. the previous Friday, he had seen a man and a woman approaching the front entrance. He described the victim's clothing with reasonable accuracy, but he could not recall any details about the man. 5:20 p.m. Bill and I decided to re-interview the victim's boyfriend, Terry Williams. At the Red Quill Bar, we were told that he had already left for the day. We got his home address.
Okay, what is it? What do you want this time?
We want to talk to you again.
Did you find Lily?
We'd like you to come downtown with us, Williams.
So she's dead.
What makes you say that?
It's true, isn't it?
You got a coat?
Are you guys arresting me?
No, we just want to get some more information.
Okay. Let me wash my face.
All right.
Joe? Take a look.
I can just get a clean shirt on.
You look fine.
Then you're not taking me in.
Now listen carefully. You have the right to remain silent. Any statements you make can and will be used against you in a court of law. Do you understand that?
Then you are arresting me.
You have the right to the presence of an attorney. If you cannot afford one, one will be appointed without charge before any questioning. Do you understand that?
Yeah, I understand. I just want to know why.
Well, that makes us even.
Hmm?
We just want to know why you've got those four beads.
Oh, I can explain those.
Suppose you do that.
Thursday night. I told you about it. It was my birthday. Lily took me to dinner. Afterwards, we came over here for a little while.
Go on.
She broke her beads. Or maybe I did. One way or the other, the string got busted. I fixed it for her and thought all the beads were on it. But when I sacked out for the night, those four turned up.
Where did they turn up?
On the couch. Except one I found in the cuff of my slacks. Now, that's the truth.
Maybe. But you didn't tell us all that this morning.
I didn't think it was important then.
Why do you think it is now? p.m. Terry Williams was booked for murder. Under interrogation, he made several conflicting statements. He admitted that last Thursday was not his birthday and that Lily Burnham had been in the habit of picking up all their tabs. He also admitted they had quarreled that night, but he continued to deny having seen her after she left his apartment around midnight. He could not satisfactorily account for his whereabouts at the approximate time of the murder. 8.05 p.m., the suspect agreed to undergo a polygraph examination. It was conducted by Lieutenant W.L. Klingon. 11.30 p.m., we were given the results of the examination.
First, let me say there were strong patterns indicating deception. For instance, a good reading on the money in the victim's billfold.
He knew how much?
On the nose. It's possible she always carried exactly $50. Some people limit themselves to a certain amount.
Yeah.
Also, a good response on the clothes she was wearing, the string of beads getting broken in a quarrel, and the general location of the crime.
What location?
Handsome Dam area. I'll return to that in a minute. I got a positive reading on the victim's death by strangulation. Now, let me ask you a question, Joe, Bill. Where was she killed?
What do you mean, Lieutenant?
Could she have been murdered somewhere else and her body moved into the house?
No, we didn't find any evidence to suggest that. None at all.
Specifically in the victim's car, parked somewhere in an alley.
You got that reaction from Williams?
Very strongly, and it was dark, rather late at night.
We've got a good witness placing the victim at the house about 2:30 Friday afternoon. We think she was strangled shortly after. Coroner might confirm the time, Joe. Yeah, we'll know after the post tomorrow.
All right, let's get back to this reaction on Hanson Dam. Could he have known she was going out there?
Well, the victim might have mentioned it the night before.
Well, I have to tell you, I got no indication at all that he knows the location of the house, or that he took her car, or that he knew where the car was found abandoned.
He just doesn't know the right things, does he? And yet he reacted to her being dead by strangulation.
That's true, but a woman being strangled in a car parked in an alley is a fairly common scene in mystery novels or on TV. Or he could have been reacting to the way he would have done it.
You mean he might have just played back to you something he'd read?
Or saw in a movie, say, in the last 24 hours. And didn't they quarrel Thursday night in his apartment?
Yeah, according to him.
Well, she got loud and disturbed the other tenants. Well, Williams may have wished he could quiet her down.
I see. Well, what's your best opinion, Lee?
Looks to me like you've got some work to do.
Yeah, how's that?
I don't think he's a good suspect.
Tuesday, June 30th, we attended the postmortem on Lily Burnham. The coroner confirmed that death was due to manual strangulation. He fixed the time of death somewhere between 2 p.m. and 4 p.m. the previous Friday. There was no evidence of sexual assault. On the basis of this information, Terry Williams was cleared and released. 11:30 a.m., Bill and I went back to the office. Bill contacted the real estate secretary, Ida Walters, and asked if she would check Lily Burnham's charge accounts. Miss Walters agreed and said she'd let us know. Friday, July 3rd, in response to a message from Ida Walters, we drove over to the Burnham Realty Company, 2:20 p.m.
Sorry I took so long.
That's all right, Miss Walters.
I knew Mrs. Burnham had many charge accounts, but nobody can find any cards or charger plates or anything, unless you found them with her.
No, ma'am, we don't have them.
Well, the only thing I could do was go through the files and look for old receipts and then verify that these accounts were still active.
Yeah.
It was the least I could do for... Anyway, it took time.
What did you find?
2 service station cards, diners club, carte blanche, an air travel card, just about all the major department stores, and Bank AmeriCard. I made this list. Sergeant, is it true what the papers say that Mrs. Burnham was... It happened last Friday afternoon?
Yes, ma'am. It's been verified.
Then I'm right.
How do you mean?
This statement just came in today from Barton's Wilshire.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, it shows that Mrs. Burnham bought a diamond wristwatch for over $400. At first, I thought the store had made a mistake.
But you called the store, did you?
Yes, sir. They said there was no mistake. They were very positive. I knew then that there was something wrong. I mean, it just isn't possible. Mrs. Burnham couldn't put a charge on her account the day after she was... Excuse me.
All right, whoever it was stole her credit cards. Figured that way he'd buy a lot of stuff that he could sell off later. He'd need a woman to use those cards.
That's right.
Made an appointment with Mrs. Burnham to look at a house. Got her alone.
Yeah.
Then he killed her.
At 4 p.m., a description of the suspect's M.O. was circulated to all police departments. A different version of this bulletin was sent to a real estate trade journal for publication. Tuesday, July 7th, a response to our bulletin came in from Phoenix, Arizona.
Man identified as Carl Keegan, alias William Simpson, victimized 9 women in Phoenix. Same M.O., stole credit cards.
Yeah, what about the description?
Good one. This Keegan's wanted on a fugitive warrant.
Yeah.
He jumped bail down there.
1 week passed. Tuesday, July 14th. We got a call from Sergeant Jack Williams, Robbery Division. He said he thought he might have something for us. Bill and I went down to the robbery squad room to see him.
Friday, Gannon.
Jack, how's it going?
Can't complain. Got a bank series going that's keeping us on the run.
Is that right?
A couple of on-ramp specialists. They're really hitting pretty good.
He said you might have something for us.
Yeah, on that realty thing you guys are working.
What do you got?
Just got back in from talking to this woman. Lady realtor down near Inglewood. Name's Roy, Ardith Roy.
Yeah, what about her?
Since about 4 days ago, she was out showing a house to a prospective buyer. Said the guy appeared interested in the house and told her he'd check back with her about making a deal in a few days.
Yeah.
Roy woman said she wrote it off as a no sale. The guy left her at the empty house, she locked up and started back for her office. On the way back, she stopped for a tank of gas. When she went to give the attendant her credit card, she noticed it was gone. Not only her gas card, but all of her cards.
Now, the man she was showing the house to, did he give a name?
Yeah, Simpson. William Simpson.
She gave you a description?
Yeah. It's all down here. There's more.
Go ahead.
Well, she figured until today, maybe she just lost the cards or misplaced them. She finished checking her morning mail. That's why she called in.
Yeah.
She got a bill from Mallard, you know, the sporting goods store?
Yeah.
Well, the bill was for $780. Most she ever bought there was a catcher's mitt for her son's birthday.
Did you check the store?
Yeah. Clerk remembers a rather nice-looking girl who charged the stuff. He asked for identification. The girl showed him all the other credit cards, so naturally, he didn't question the purchase. Big store. Doubtful if anybody would know the Roy woman on site.
That it?
Well, that's it. Whoever you're looking for, sorry I can't serve him up on a plate, but it ties, doesn't it?
Sure sounds like it, Jack. Now, this realtor, she say anything about the man's behavior?
She said he appeared courteous, looked the house over carefully, appeared straight enough to her.
How'd this Simpson get to her purse, she say?
Told her she left it on the kitchen sink. The two of them wandered through the house. When they got to one of the back bedrooms, the guy said he'd like to take one more look at the kitchen. She stayed in the bedroom, and he went to the kitchen by himself.
Thanks, Jack.
Got anything going for you?
We put a notice in the real estate trade journal. About all we can do is wait and hope it brings rain.
And in the meantime, there are a lot of empty houses to show.
And a lot of credit cards to steal.
Wednesday, July 22nd, 10:45 a.m. We got our first break.
Woman realtor out of Pacoima just phoned in. Name's Esther Jenkins. Saw her notice in the trade journal. Says she's got a date to show a house in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Description fits Keegan.
11:15 a.m. We arrived at the address given us by the realtor who had telephoned in. Mrs. Esther Jenkins.
I think you'll really enjoy the home. It seems to have everything you're looking for.
Yes, I believe this is just what I want.
Hello. Would you gentlemen like to see the house?
Police officers.
Stand still.
You're Esther Jenkins?
That's right.
Just a moment. I don't think you have a right to do this.
We have a right to look at your identification.
And I'm entitled to know why.
You've been the route. There's a fugitive want on you. You jumped bail in Arizona. Let's have your name.
William Simpson.
Miss Jenkins, are you carrying any credit cards?
Yes, I am.
Would you mind showing them to us?
No, not at all. I always carry them with me. That's strange. I had them just a few minutes ago.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm positive. I always carry them with me.
I hope you're not accusing me of taking them.
Well, now, maybe your name's Esther Jenkins. That's what it says on these credit cards.
You can't do a thing until I talk to my attorney.
Miss Jenkins?
Yes. Those are mine, all right.
All right, put your hands behind your back.
Just a minute. Who do you think you're pushing around?
We're not pushing you around, but since you don't seem to know, I'll tell you what your name is. It's Carl Keegan. You killed a realtor by the name of Lily Burnham, just like you would have this woman if she'd found out you stole these cards.
You can't prove any of that.
Well, we're going to try.
You made a mistake, and I'm not going to pay for it.
You're going to use a credit card?
Just seen is true. The names were changed to protect the innocent.
On September 20th, trial was held in Department 185, Superior Court of the State of California for the County of Los Angeles. In a moment, the results of that trial. The suspect was found guilty of murder in the first degree. Murder in the first degree is punishable by death or confinement in the state prison for life, at the discretion of the court or jury trying the same. Subsequent investigation led to the identification and arrest of Carl Keegan's female accomplice, who was tried and found guilty on 5 counts of forgery. Forgery is punishable by imprisonment in the state prison for not less than 1 year, nor more than 14 years, or by imprisonment in the county jail for not more than 1 year.
You guys can hear me. Well, my boy is weirding out here, and says I'm disconnected. Let me try something else. Hold on. Okay, here we go. All right, we're back in business. All right, the politics of population, that's what I have on the docket for this morning. But, boy, it's been quiet all this week. I don't know, people are getting spring fever too early, man. Well, today is March 1st. Okay, well, what I'll do, well, let me see. We might play one more selection here from the archives and knock off early for today. All right, let's go with Balling on Balls again. If nobody's popping up by then, we'll save the politics of population for another day.
before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo, because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 apiece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude.
That bitch good, nigga.
Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She struck you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga kid. That nigga hurt himself.
You from New State.
It's over. It's over. It's over. When I say it's over, everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
I ain't told you. I'll slap the fuck out of one of
real quick.
What a job.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening, because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
All right, boy. Boys run kind of, I mean, it's just a light day, light week so far this week. Okay, well, we'll cover the politics of population another day. And, well, you know what, we might fit it in on Friday. And then it deserves its own day because tomorrow, okay. All right, well. Okay, unless somebody raises their hand, we're going to cut it loose for today. Let's go to Cuddy and then we'll go out from there.
How'd it go?
We got one out of two of them motherfuckers, you know?
You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
Yo, B.I., man, I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man, you know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man. We was blazing, though. It was late.
All right, relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday, you know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised at you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know.
Hold on. So on me. I had that kid in my sights. Close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you that lets you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
Alright. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're gonna put you on a corner, you could be inside.
Oh, man. I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
But you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you gonna do?
I don't know. But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
B, he was a man in his time, you know?
Yeah. He a man today. Yeah, man.